others of them got through to Holland, were working with Elsevier and other publishers, and some of them I think got out to America. So there was that. Elsevier then, with this expertise, published its first journal, Biochemica, Biophysica Acta, in 1947, and that was their first one. And, you know, that's in about eight parts now, and they've just rolled on from there. But we will turn now to Robert Maxwell to give it rather a more of a human touch. Maxwell's a really interesting character. I mean, breathtaking. A brief synopsis of his life is that he was from the Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia as it then was, near the Romanian border. He was Jewish, so had to get out ahead of the Nazis, and he joined the British Army in 1940, at the age of about 16.
That's right.
It's staggering reading how young Maxwell was when he did all of these things. He was, a war hero. He was a war hero and a risk taker. Yeah. So all of that fits in with, you know, with his later career. He was in the British Army. He, at one stage, he gave himself the name Leslie Du Maurier. He had I forget his Czech name, so he was called Leslie Du Maurier after the cigarettes, not after the novelist. And then he stumbled on the name of another soldier he knew who was fortunately not alive any longer, called Ian Robert Maxwell. So he decided Ian Robert Maxwell was a quite a distinguished British sounding name. To his big advantage that he had over the English, he spoke languages, Paul Rosebud said, yes, he spoke eight languages, all of them badly.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a nice one. But he was fluent in a number of languages, and which was really helpful with his career because he was involved in this transition. So he could speak in German and in Russian to people and so on.
English and perhaps French.
English, yes. And his English was, you know, he was a Labour Member of Parliament,
yes.
And all sorts of things. Anyway, Maxwell, after the war, had a job in Berlin with the kind of British Army there running the place. And because he spoke German and Russian, he was a helpful guy. He edited a newspaper at one stage, but turned into a kind of dealer, what they call a dealer in commodities.
Right, he ended up being like a distributor, didn't he?
Yeah, he had through his newspaper thing, he had access to paper, so people needed that, and then he kind of at some stage came across a whole bunch of journals.
That's right,
that were hanging around, and he realised that scientific material. These were German journals that nobody had. So he realised these had economic value.
Yeah, and economic value to English-speaking countries like Britain and the US.
Yep, exactly. So he was selling those. And then he moved to London in the late 40s, I think, and through various shenanigans, and everything about him is shady.
He's an opportunist.
He's an opportunist, yeah. I mean, it's funny reading this the various things that we've read about Maxwell, is that people who worked for him said he was this great guy and this visionary who occasionally did dodgy things. Other people say he was this really dodgy guy who occasionally did great things. They will say that begrudgingly. Anyway, through various shady dealings involving Butterworths and so on, he ended up with something called Butterworths Press, or a deal with Butterworths in the late 40s, early 50s, with a guy called Paul Rosbaud, who had come from Leipzig, and he was a German scientist who had gone into publishing. And Rosbaud's fans say that he was really the brains behind the thing and got Pergamon going, and they started some journals.
It certainly seemed like that from the readings that we did, and that he was the one that had the relationships and with the academics and kept the press going.
Yeah, that's right. And through that early period, Maxwell was really involved with a, more with a book distribution business. He owned Pergamon Press, but he didn't take much interest in it. But his book distribution business went bankrupt, and various people, not him, lost money. So then he really observed what Rothbard was doing, which was having close relationships mm-hmm. with scientists. Mm-hmm. So he observed that quite closely, and then in 1956 he sacked Rothbard proceeded to, he really worked into this way of operating, which gave scientists and his editors and academics a great deal of freedom.
Yes, he did. Yes, definitely. He also kind of really nurtured them as well. And a lot of people owed their reputation to him, and because he would publish them, and then they would have kind of a symbiotic relationship almost.
Yeah. Well, what had happened with the scholarly societies? That's why I talked about the way in which they ran. They really were not only the old boys' network, but the hierarchy.
Right.
Whereas what Rothbard and Maxwell got onto is that there were lots of young scientists who were struggling to get into journals because the work they were doing was very new, and these old codgers didn't particularly understand it or were sympathetic. So Maxwell recognised that you could get to these people and say, hey, would you like to be editor of a journal?
And then they would kind of sort of be a bit of
they had real freedom. He didn't interfere in that side.
And he also he was quite lavish with parties or sort of
spent a lot of money on people.
It says some of the documents say that he would look after his editors as well, and treat them well.
I mean, they were also publishing books, reference books, and encyclopedias and so on, and that helped fund the new journals, because journals took a few years. They needed to sell them to libraries and so on and establish their reputation. That helped fund the new journals, and also he used the books as a little incentive scheme for editors. He would go and poach somebody from another publisher, and he would get to know them and then offer to publish their book.
Mm-hmm.
So this would go, and there's the, I don't know if you read the lovely story about talking about cakes.
He published an editor's wife's cookbook on cakes or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, and what one third prize, one bronze medal.
It was very successful, but a
book fair.
Sort of endeavours like that didn't pay out. But it's actually quite interesting that you say that it does take a long time to establish a journal, and that the subscriptions just don't come automatic, and that a journal having 400 subscriptions was actually quite a good thing.
That's right, and. The other thing was, we already talked about, it was a time when libraries and universities were growing. Library committees were probably dominated by scientists. There was money going into science. So that the deal that they discovered with journal publishing was that there wasn't real competition. If you had the Journal of... cryobiology. So you got the cryobiologists and you filled that, and then you realised there was some more, that journal was getting plenty of subscriptions. You could start the International Journal of Cryobiology. And people didn't cancel one to buy the other. They had to buy the second one. Libraries had to buy the second one as well. So they did a lot of slicing and dicing like that. So this is how you end up with, A's, but, journals A, B, and C and so on.
So and earlier we talked about scholarly societies and how journals were circulated through subscriptions to or membership of a scholarly society. But in the States, up until Second World War, they actually had a page charge.
Page charges.
And then because Europeans found it very difficult to pay those page charges, and so they what they did was to kind of ameliorate that, they had open-ended journals, and I didn't realise that was sort of like a development after the Second World War, is that you just kept increasing the issues per volume.
Well, that's yeah.
Am you I could, jumping you could, ahead?
No. Well, yeah, but that's fine. That's fine. So, this system went ahead. At once, they ended up with 700 titles. Pergamon, Elsevier, and North Holland had rather more. But if you think about it, you know, 700 journal titles, you know, that's a journal a week for mm-hmm. new journal a week for 15 years.
That's a lot.
So that's really going for it. So mm-hmm. And partly they were able to they ran a lean mean operation, but gave a lot of power to a lot of power, and also a lot of the work went out to academic staff who were being paid by the universities.
And of course, this is in conjunction with developments in the processing or the manufacturing of journals as well. And typesetting, for example. There were changes there and improvements in technology.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
not that this is possibly a thing that we're covering here.
Oh no. Well, I think it's actually really interesting. Scientific publishing was always a specialised business,
mm-hmm.
So that with things like formulae and so on and graphics. So some of the journal publishers' names we know now quite well, like Taylor and Francis. Mm-hmm. Taylor and Francis were actually a printing firm,
right?
Who then got into this business when they saw that it was a good business to get into.
A lot of money to be made.
Yeah, a lot of money to be made, and moving it in other directions than the pure sciences. So yeah, that is a all of that is highly relevant. And the other thing that they did, being driven by the academics and operating in a system in which there was quite a lot of money flowing in, they produced a very high standard, high quality product.
Mm-hmm.
With graphics production values and so on. So, a couple of other things that Maxwell did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he takes credit for it. It's hard to know what he did and what it was that other people did. But some of his fans give him credit for things that you think, well, that sounds a bit dodgy, but he's credited with it. It's the exchange rates business.
Right, let's talk about that.
Yeah, and that's why there was a serious crisis in the 1970s.
So from memory, that is because the American dollar was the benchmark for everyone else, and it was so strong the American universities, well, they kind of thought that the European publishers, that their prices were very stable, that's just because the exchange rate was so much in their favour.
Yeah, librarians don't necessarily come out of this covered entirely with glory, that the American librarians were quite happy. The price of these journals never went up. They were charged in American dollars. If they had been charged in British pounds, which was the currency under which the journals were produced, their costs would have been going down. But instead, they just had this lovely, oh, the prices never increased. The profits continue to increase, and increasing profits means high production values.
Mm-hmm.
Expectations of high profit in the business, also the ability to keep investing in new journals.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they got to 700 titles.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's always struck me that someone has said, perhaps you can confirm this, that actually publishers, they got their raw materials for free, basically. So they basically got their articles for free. They never had to pay for them. Obviously, there's publishing costs, but the raw materials.
Yeah, that's right. But it wasn't seen like that in those days, because all these people had been doing the work for the scholarly societies anyway.
Right, I see. So it kind of came out of that historical situation.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't anything different.
And they saw themselves as, what they liked was the autonomy.
Right.
And they liked
academic
freedom, all of that. They liked the lavish parties.
Yeah.
they liked having their books published, you know. He was, you know, Maxwell would find out who was the new person in the field, phone them up and offer them, would you like to be editor of your own journal?
And he also did lots of grants and funding.